Coming up next, a nice conversation with David Kipfeth. It's outside. It's at a festival. You're going to hear all the ambient sounds of festival goings on. David is an extremely talented banjo player with a lot of history and the formation of bluegrass up in the northeast corner, which is where we're sitting, northeast corner of the country up in Oak Hill, New York. And he's an amazing painter, drawer, too. So a lot of history involved. David's a good guy, great banjo player. Thanks so much, David Kipfeth, for coming over in the rain and sitting under the awning so that we could talk for Unreal Bluegrass. This is it, David Kipfeth. Really happy to welcome a friend, David Kipfeth, to a nice little pickup interview we're doing here at Gray Fox. David's always here. He's a mainstay in bluegrass in the northeast region and beyond, and every year I see him here, and I just thought, well, we should probably talk. David, how are you?
I'm good. I'm a little tired right now.
And why is that?
Muddied in and trying to figure out how to get out of here by after this afternoon after my last set.
And the set that David's talking about, he comes in, and these are really long sets because they're dance. They're dance tutors and dance, and it's like you have to just get rock solid onto the song and play until for several hours at a time.
Pretty much. It's a typical dance situation. Trish does a clog dance workshop because she was in the Greengrass Cloggers along with Earl White. She was one of the founding members, I believe, of the Greengrass Cloggers. So she's a master, and she can get people that obviously have never done this doing all this stuff. It's just really amazing to watch. And I dance like Frankenstein with cement blocks taped to his ankles, so, and I can't follow directions. I'm the guy that the caller always said, the other right arm. You know, so my strength is playing for dances, and we can just play these tunes. It's like playing in an old-time session. You know, you play the tune until it's done.
Yeah.
And you play the tunes, and you can do maybe three of them in a row, and maybe 15 or 20 times each until the dance is done. And it's great. So, you know, you just keep experimenting, you know, with a tune. You just go back and forth, up and down the neck, and, you know, it's really cool.
I haven't mentioned, but David spends most of his bluegrass life as a banjo player, and we have mutual friends. And David's a great banjo player, and I always enjoy coming here seeing him at Gray Fox, and I thought I could just talk him in about prior to Gray Fox. And even still, you play a lot.
Yeah, I live up in the Seacoast area, just above Kittery, Maine, and there's a lot of music going on there. 25 or 26 years I lived over in Saratoga Springs and Cafe Lena, which is the oldest independent cafe in the United States, is over there. And that's the one thing I miss about not being in Saratoga, because they had great music there. But as far as the jam scene and the music scene and all the venues for my friend Steve Roy and his wife and their band called Old Hat, they play a lot, and I play with them sometimes. And Cecil Abels runs he's the head of the New England Bluegrass Band, which I think we're playing here. We're playing at Thomas Point next year. So, you know, I'm in that band, and, you know, there's so much stuff going on in the Seacoast area. I don't know where to turn next. It's incredible.
You've been playing banjo for, I'm not going to guess for how long, but you've watched all the changes in bluegrass, basically. Great player. So I want you to see if you can go back a little bit, and let's say when David's picked up a banjo and decided that was the instrument for him.
See, 1961 was the first time I picked up a banjo, and it was where I went to school. It was during the folk scare, and there were people breaking, you know, it was a boys' school, and the people forming groups like the Lime Liars kind of, and the Kingston Trio-ish kind of thing, and the Four Freshmen and all this stuff. And then there was the Brigands, the ne'er-do-wells, and the, you know. And
I don't know the term brigand.
Tramps and thieves. You know, we were the rough crowd of Hopkins, and I heard my friend Sal DeMeo, who lives up in upstate Vermont, and he was the first guy I heard play really good banjo, and he's good, and he still is. And in the same way that Bela was riding with his family, in the back seat of the car, and the Jed Clamp had came on the radio, and he said, "I don't know what that is, but that's what I do." So that's what it was for me in the banjo. So I did that, started in 61, and 62 I took up the guitar.
So you mentioned the Great Folk Scare, as it's called. Were you playing folk music and around that time a lot of it transformed into what we call bluegrass?
Well, no, it was I straddled the fence. I mean, when I started, there was a guy who was I was in a band with the band leader was a guy named Billy Hamilton, who later in life wound up he's passed now, unfortunately, like last year, but he wound up being the dean of students at Wake Forest College, but he got a PhD at Yale in Russian and Czech literature, but he was from Cincinnati, and he used to cross over to your territory and to go see the Osborne Brothers at Red's Mill Cafe in Covington. And so I started hanging around him and his band, which was the Gray Sky Boys, and I became, the local pest. And eventually he started another band called the Ohio River Boys in New Haven. And I think I just to shut me up, I think he made me a member of the band. But I wound up being his tenor singer, and he taught me everything I know about bluegrass. He knew more about, we'd sit around his kitchen table, drinking cowboy coffee and analyzing Monroe quartets, and it was just incredible what we did. That was basically my entry into the Connecticut coast scene, which was really rich. And when he left, we formed Apple Country. And Phil Rosenthal and I and Bud Morrisrow and Mark Rickard and a couple other guys founded that group.
Is Rickard the same? Like, I have tuners on my band.
No, that's Ricard.
Ricard.
This is Rickard.
Rickard, all right.
He's now in Willow Street, Pennsylvania, and last I heard, he was a math teacher. And I don't know if he's still there or not. I haven't lost track of him. But I'm in touch with Phil quite a bit. And we're playing, we're going to be at a memorial for Phil Zimmerman coming up, in this fall. So we'll reunion and start, play some music together.
I'm from Kentucky, and people that aren't familiar maybe with where the music is located. Okay, I'm in the bluegrass state, okay, and Bill Monroe was born there and all that. But sure. People will say, well, there must be a lot of bluegrass, and there really isn't. But I always say, it seems to me it's more northeast, and that would include where you're talking about.
Well, you can thank Ralph Rinsler for that, to a great degree, band. Why can't I think of the band? John Harold and Greenbrier Boys. I think basically he was the one that really got Monroe and Doc Watson and all these guys to come north. And when he met Doc was playing rockabilly, and he owned like a gold Les Paul. He didn't even own a Martin, and he sold that guitar so he could buy his D18 so he could start playing these folk, Appalachian folk, whatever you want to call it. As far as the Northeasterners were concerned, they just loved it, So, he's the one who really, I think, got, and then, all the New York crowd, Bernie Clay, all those guys started booking bluegrass bands. And I wound up having more people to play with around just in the coast area, and then there's the Boston scene and Washington Square scene with Eric Weisberg and Mark Horwitz all those guys, and Steve Mendel,
yep.
And they all just kind of convened in these little lit up gems of places and made this music come alive.
So very few people know, you would, of course, maybe some of the listeners don't realize that, Doc Watson in the early days was playing rockabilly electric guitar,
yeah.
And very well.
Yeah.
And he just decided to become Doc Watson, the master of the...
And he never lost that. He kept that jivey thing. Earl Scruggs did a tune, a famous tune called Foggy Mountain Special. And it's real jivey. And Earl listened to a lot of horn players. particularly, you know, that's my understanding. New Orleans players, and so somebody asked him one time, say, Earl, how were you inspired to write, you know, Foggy Mountain Special? And he said, well, you know, it's that boogie woogie. So now all I think about when I play that tune is I'm playing boogie woogie.
I have to laugh because when I was learning to play, I only had the record that came with Earl's book. And in there he talks about a boogie woogie style of bat, and he says it the same way. Said it wasn't an Aphex. That's how he really said boogie woogie.
Well, and a lot of that stuff that he played was horn influenced. Those are all horn licks. Those are all everything. A lot of that, based on his knowledge of the neck, which I call the golden ladder. It's a series of patterns up and down the neck, which I have to send you my treatise on the golden ladder.
Okay.
Everything he learned was that he came up with was all based on his knowledge of all those patterns up and down the neck, and in his head, you know, that swing. It's like, you know, and Monroe, it's the swing. Everybody, a lot of people play these, you know, sweetheart, I beg you to come home, and I can play things way too fast.
Yeah.
And that's not where the groove lives. The groove lives in the swing, you know. And the bluesy swing, and that's what Monroe heard. I mean, there were some songs that he intended to be fast, obviously. But a lot of the narrative songs and personal songs were really a lot more swingy.
I've heard a lot of people tell me a lot about Monroe, which I know nothing but what I learned, but I think that might be one of the best descriptions of what would influence his choice of notes and his feel for what he was doing. I don't know that I was really aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, to the great Miles Davis. I mean, a lot of what he played was what he left out. You know, and the same thing is true of Earl. I mean, his space that he chooses to leave. You know, and Bill Keith and you know, Tommy Thompson. Tommy Thompson.
Bobby
Thompson.
Yeah.
And Eric Weisberg and all those guys, I mean, that was a different approach because they were seriously looking for melodic style, note-for-note representation. I mean, even though there was so much more to Bill Keith than that, I mean, his genius of orchestral arrangement and his knowledge of music, that was the bedrock of Bill Keith. But, you know, that was a step away from holes that you leave. It's things that you fill with the melody, you know, so that was a totally different approach.
I think, and I can't think of a Thelonious Monk quote that I used. I'm a big jazz fan, but he had a really good quote about space in music. And Miles Davis did too, but I can't think of the one. Monk, but basically, that is not what you play; it's what you don't play.
It's what you don't play,
and that's where you're really grappling.
There's a joke about that where this guy brings this kid, never heard jazz, brings him to a Miles Davis concert. Miles, the band comes out, starts riffing and stuff. Miles Davis comes out, and he just sits around. He's got his horn on his lap. He sits around, and pretty soon people start clapping. And the kid says, I don't get it. What are they clapping for? I don't hear anything. He's not playing anything. And he said, yeah, but it's what he's thinking.
That's pretty good if you can get applause for what people think you're going to be thinking about.
Yeah, well, it's people learn spaces that people leave and why they leave them, and then they start to appreciate that.
You know, I don't have any particular name in mind, but there are so many good young technical players that can, and I don't think they should fill every space.
Oh yeah.
And I think it takes away a lot because after a while it becomes like white noise.
There's a degree of testosterone poisoning here, you know, at work. I mean that in a joking way, you know, because it's the drive of the youth. It's got to, you know, make it loud and all this stuff. And, you know, you learn, as you get older, you learn to just be calmer, you know.
You make people wait for your they want to be, the other thing is just an onslaught to me. Some of the stuff is just an onslaught of notes, which I appreciate technically.
Oh, I do too.
Like, wow, but it's just like, I don't even know what you're doing anymore.
But if you're lucky, then you start to understand that and translate that into your playing.
Yeah.
To, you know, as you get older, and start to learn what to not play, what not to play.
Yeah, you know? That's the key. That's great. Here we are sitting in front of Bill Keith 10.
I know, there it is, right in front of me.
So we're kind of like being overshadowed by Bill as we talk.
I know, that's why he's in my head a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Musically, his skill, I never could even imagine it. I mean, I remember Tony Triska and I walking in at banjo camp on about to turn in, and Keith over in the corner working out something like How High the Moon with these giant fistfuls of chords that he, we were just like standing there with our mouths open. I mean, it was incredible. And I always appreciated it, and I have played some melodic stuff, you know, experimented with it a little bit, and I stick it in every once in a while, but I have this real problem when I get going on a melodic thing is like spinning a prayer wheel backwards. I unlearn it as I play it. It's a weird thing, and it's just me being right-brained. I'm not technically, mathematically or technically oriented guy.
And as we all know, Bill Keith, if there was a more technical, mathematically oriented player, I don't know who it would be.
Oh, I just can't imagine anybody. I mean, Sonny certainly had degrees of it, his knowledge. I mean, his knowledge of jazz and his ways of arranging things. I mean,
he played
a lot of genius.
Horns. Horns influenced his playing.
Yeah, and Don too. Don Reno.
Yeah. Sonny told me once that music, all of music to him, was a straight line. So that's the only way I can explain it.
Yeah.
He just couldn't say anymore. It's just like, it's all out there, straight line.
It is. Yeah. And also how Earl, in fact, like mechanically too, it's a straight line historically, but the way Earl. It's really important for Earl is you listen to Earl, all of his notes, the edges of his notes are tied together like piano hinges, playing each note ahead of the next note. So when one finger was playing like a forward roll, thumb was on a string, the next finger was already on the next string. And when that string was played, the next finger was on the next string. So as a result, his line of notes sounded like a conversation. Like a spoken sentence rather than individual notes dancing, you know, along like karaoke, you know? That's not what he was about. He was like a stream, like messed up stream, you know? It was like an unsullied expression. And that's what made, that's why he had so much mercury and fire in his playing. I mean, it was his soul, and he had that ever peaceful sort of satisfied little smirk that he always had, you know, and
because he knew he could go where he wanted to go. He knew what he was thinking, and he knew he could get there and be solid and be perfect on the notes, in addition to the ideas.
And every once in a while, on a rare occasion, you can see on the radio shows that every once in a while he'd flub a note, and everybody make a big joke out of it. He didn't care. But I remember one story. A kid came up to him, and he had one of these harmony Bakelite banjos, you know, simple, which to my experience can sound really good. And so he said, "Well, Mr. Scruggs, would you like to try my banjo?" And he said, "Well, sure, son." You know, being the guy that he was, so he picked up the banjo and started playing. He sounded just like Earl.
Just
sounded exactly like Earl.
Like it's because it sounded like Earl. Almost yeah. You put in his hands.
No, I know. It's because of his heart. It's because of what was in there coming out. I mean, he could have played anything. The ukulele, and he probably still would have sounded like Earl.
Amazing. And he did that so long ago, and people still pursue that.
They do. And I mean, you can, you know, people say, well, you know, but there's this, you know, Snuffy Jenkins, you know. Well, yes, he was a great player, but he didn't quite have the solidity yet. And I mean, he was not destined to have that solidity that Earl got. Earl translated it, you know, because I think the story was that I don't know whether it was Horace or one of his brothers and stuff, and you know, he was messing around with the banjo, and he had played. His mother was a clawhammer player. Somebody said to him, "Well, did you ever play clawhammer like your mom?" He said, "Well, I can never make my fingers wiggle like that." somebody said, well, you've made a lot of money making your fingers wiggle the way they wiggle. You know, but then he was experimenting with two fingers. Which, you know, was a guy that used to play for Bill, and I can't remember his name. I never remember his name. He was a short guy. He looked like one of the Dillards. So good. I mean, he was a killer two-finger player. And so, like, Earl was playing Ruben's train. And he was just kind of messing around with two fingers, and all of a sudden, he started using his third finger, and he went, oh, my God. You know. And he ran out and said, Horace, I've got it, you know. And so from that point on, that's when he experimented. That's when he really created that three finger thing.
And that's really what added all that all the syncopated sound. It allowed things to line up and fit in together and integrated so well.
It's incredible. I mean, enabled Bill, because Bill experimented. I mean, like String Bean was an unbelievable player, particularly. Well, he was a great clawhammer player, but he was a massively important two-finger guy. I mean, he was incredible. That, what is it, 20-cent cotton and 90-cent meat? How in the world can a poor man eat? You know, that one that he sat in on that flat scrug ship. Unbelievable two-finger player. So Monroe kind of was headed in that direction, you know? I mean, first he had the accordion, and he was trying to figure out like Glenn Miller was trying to figure out his sound, and then all of a sudden one day with the wall of saxophones, he got it, and he knew when he got it. And so I asked Monroe one time, I said, so when Lester introduced Earl to you, what did you think? I said, did you say, wow, that's really it? And there was a nice long pause. And I said, or was it somebody that you could use? He said, yeah. I said, yeah, I see. He said, it was just somebody I could use.
You could use, yeah, sure.
It's like,
literally.
No, it's not somebody who helped you create the sound that you're known for or anything like that, you know? It was so funny. I thought, yeah, okay, Bill, whatever.
You're taking me back to a lot of History Channel.
Oh, I know. Well,
it's great.
I have
stuff.
This in my head all the time. Yeah. You know, when I play, I mean, it's just like I always had one foot in the folk world and one foot in the bluegrass world, but I'm always really, you know, Earl changed my life. Really did. I had an art mentor that changed my life, and I had an Earl changed
I should,
my life.
And I should mention that, too, that David is a really incredible artist, all kinds of work, and pencil drawings, and the things you do that are with ink that look so real, they look like a real thing, and the fact you would do them in ink is courage beyond.
Because I do things a little bit at a time.
Yeah, I hope so. I've seen things, I haven't looked at them in a while, but I'm thinking, well, that looks real. And you go, no, it's, but then I think, oh, it's been, you know, you sneeze. Well, if you sneeze and your ink thing moves,
Well, I learn things slowly. I mean, it's kind of like I always give this joke lecture to prospective students, and that's that in everybody's head is a little room up there in their head, and with glass windows in the door, and everybody in, and they're all lined up in chairs, and they all look like they're from Gary Larson cartoons. You know, their eyes are too close together, spinning independently of each other, and they're all going, and I say, don't go to that room. So my point is, when I'm working something out, I do it really deliberately. You know, I work it out really deliberately and slowly.
It's already in your mind.
Yeah, it's the muscle memory. You know, it's got. I want to get the head in the muscle memory there before so I don't create a cartoon. And that's one problem is people get really good, but if they don't have a full understanding of where the music they're playing is from. Or the history behind it, they run the risk of creating a cartoon. It's interesting to me.
It's interesting.
And you can hear it, too. I mean, like, you can hear the difference. Like, that's like the Seldom Seen set last night.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. I mean, talk about a woven history lesson, a musical history lesson, those guys. I mean, if you line them all up and think, you know, one at a time, who did what with whom, when, and how, I mean, it's mind-boggling, you know? and you can tell that they care about the precision of their harmonies and stuff like that. And that, to me, that's like a really important thing. Like, you could never hear Earl sing baritone. You could never hear J.D. Crowe sing baritone. But you could hear when they weren't there.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. People forget how J.D. was always in there.
A master baritone singer. Unbelievable. I mean, and of course, a banjo player, too. But Ronnie killed me last night. I mean, Ron Stewart, man, what a player. And then Phil playing he's the real deal. He's like Riley Bogus is in old-time music. It's the real deal, you know. You know Riley?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Ronnie, I'm in awe of every time I see him, every time someone mentions Ron Stewart. First time I ever saw him was with Lynn Morris.
Yep, so me too.
It was Marshall and, was it Jesse Brock might have been?
Maybe. I saw him at the old banjo camp north up in Groton.
Okay.
Grotonwood.
And so before they come out, there's a banjo and a fiddle and all kind of like in a circle.
Yeah.
It's like, what's that for? Well, that's where Ronnie started. In case they need a banjo, fiddle, or he play guitar, he play whatever you want. So they just all laid out like a little
half-star. Yeah, he just picks up one thing and then picks up another thing, and then he's like, okay, whatever, you know. Whatever fits, you know.
I wish when he was with J.D. that he played fiddle with J.D. mostly because of that J.D. But I wish they'd have done more.
It was so funny because, as I recall, he joined J.D. What he said was, you know, until Lynn recovers, which, of course, people knew that she was not going to. That was a tragic loss of epic proportions. But playing fiddle with Lynn, oh, my God, it was just perfect. And she was a great three-finger player, too.
Great player.
I mean, a lot of people only think of her like Ola Bell Reed, you know, a clawhammer player. But, boy, I tell you, she was a great three-finger player.
She was. She absolutely was.
And a great person, too, on top of
that. Oh, what a sweetheart. And
she still is. I mean, you know, but, I mean, she just she doesn't have the wherewithal anymore.
David, I'm going to let you get ready to go somewhere else. Yeah, it was good talking.
I've loved everything that you've done. And I love your hat, too. Thank you.
That's great.
I bribed
David by giving him a pick piece out.
So see, now I'm going to do your drawing. I have to come up with a drawing.
You don't have to.
No, I'm going to.
So that's what I do. I bribe people to come on the show. I give them hats.
Oh, excellent. It worked.
Yes, it did. I didn't even think about it at the time, but yeah, it worked. All right, David. This
has been a blast. Gray Fox with David
Kiffith, and enjoyed it so much.
Ciao, everybody.
All right, thanks.
That was right at the campsite, as you figured out. That's David Kiffith. I enjoy doing that. I wish so many more of the people that are on the program could be in a live spot like that, and then maybe in a festival setting, because you get to hear babies crying, and you hear vehicles drive. It wasn't a helicopter, it kind of sounds like it, but you hear a small vehicle drive by, and you hear people talking, and in the distance you hear music. I really like to do that. Because I feel like I'm there again, and I hopefully when you hear an interview like that, maybe you feel like you're sitting tent side also. I hope so. Thanks so much, David. I'll catch you next year, hopefully some point. Thank you for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass.